Welcome to America's Providential History Podcast, where we talk about the real story of America and explore the hand of God in our history. Now, here's your host, Stephen McDowell.
Hello, I'm glad you're joining us for this edition of America's Providential History Podcast. Today, we will be taking a look at the father of our country, George Washington, and in particular, looking at Washington as a man of providence. You know, almost every American has heard of George Washington. Most would know he was our first president and that he is called the father of our country. Many would know he was the commanding general during the American Revolution. Some may even recognize Henry Lee's eulogy of Washington, that statement that he made, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. But after this, Americans' knowledge is minimal. Now, in the past, Washington would have been known, studied, and admired by every American. He was recognized as the indispensable man. Well, sadly, few today understand why he has been called the world's apostle of liberty, which is the title I use for the book that I wrote a number of years ago, a brief bio of George Washington entitled The Apostle of Liberty, The World-Changing Leadership of George Washington, which, by the way, you can get a copy of this book on our website, providencefoundation.com, as well as many other books and materials there. So please check it out at providencefoundation.com. And so here are the world's apostle of liberty. Now, President Calvin Coolidge expressed what was common knowledge throughout most of our history. On Washington's birthday on February 22nd, 1927, President Coolidge gave a speech in which he said this: Washington was the directing spirit without which there would have been no independence, no union, no constitution, and no republic. His ways were the ways of truth. His influence grows. In wisdom of action and purity of character, he stands alone. We cannot yet estimate him. We can only indicate our reverence for him and thank the divine providence which sent him to serve and inspire his fellow men. Now, President Coolidge expressed why Washington was indispensable and how he came to serve the nation. He said that divine providence sent him. See, everyone used to know this about Washington, that he was a man of providence. Sadly, most people today are ignorant of this. So Washington was a man of providence in the sense that he often in his writings spoke of the providence of God, acknowledging God's hand in history and his life and the events that were taking place, very important events in the history of our nation and of the world. But he also demonstrated and manifested the providence of God in his life and spoke about that often. On August 20th, 1778, Washington wrote in a letter, he was looking back over the first 3 years of the American Revolution. He, of course, was selected as the commanding general of the Revolution in the summer of 1775 after the British fired upon the Americans at Lexington. And 3 years later, looking back over all the events that had taken place, he wrote that the hand of providence has been so conspicuous in all of this that he must be worse than an infidel that lacks faith and more than wicked that is not gratitude enough to acknowledge his obligations. And so Washington was indicting most of modern academia when he said this. He said, look, if you can't see the hand of providence in the events of the American Revolution and these historical events that take place, that you must be worse than an infidel and more than wicked. And so when I wrote my brief biography of Washington some years ago, I didn't want Washington to indict me. So what I do in that book is highlight the providence of God in the words of George Washington, and in the events of his life. Because early on, we can see the hand of providence very conspicuous in the life of Washington, as he was saying here. In fact, back when Washington was a young man in his early 20s, he was a colonel in the Virginia militia. Now, of course, this is about two decades before America became an independent nation. Virginia was still a British colony. And during this time, it was a period which was known as the French and Indian War, that the French and British were fighting here in the Americas as well as over in Europe. In America, some of it had to do with disputes over Western boundaries, this territory. And when the French came and began to build a fort on area that was part of the territory of Virginia, the governor of Virginia sent George Washington. Again, he was a young leader in the Virginia militia, to deliver a message to the French: get off our land, off our territory. And when the French did not do this, the British sent troops under the command of General Braddock to drive the French off of the British soil, Virginia soil. Now, when Braddock arrived with the troops, they were used to doing warfare as they had done in Europe, where opposing forces would line up on the field of battle, face one another in line, fire upon them, and see who could kill the most people the most rapidly to decide the victor in the battle. And so, but Washington and the Virginia militia warned General Braddock. He said, the French are not going to fight you this way. And the French had enlisted some Native Americans, some Indians, to fight along with them. So they're not going to fight you like this. But General Braddock didn't listen to them. And so they marched. They were marching out in the wilderness toward where the French fort was building this fort in the area which is near Pittsburgh today. And they were perfect targets with their red coats on for the French and Indians who were hiding behind the rocks and trees. And when they came into their field, they began to fire upon them, again, making perfect targets. Now, the strategy of the French and the Indians was to kill the officers. They thought, if we kill the officers, we'll have them. And during this battle, in fact, it really wasn't a battle. It would have been a complete massacre if it wasn't for the heroics of the Virginia militia. But during this time, 85% of the officers were killed or wounded. General Braddock was shot, died not long after this. Washington, as one of the leaders, was singled out as well. And he began to be fired upon by the French and Indians hiding behind the rocks and the trees. An Indian chief said of this incident of him trying to shoot Washington, he said, after striving in vain to hit him, became alarmed and told his men to desist from firing at one who is plainly under the care of the great Manitou. That was their name of their great spirit, their great God. So Washington was singled out, fired upon. One Indian said, I had 17 fair fires at him, and after all, couldn't bring him to the ground. The Indian chiefs, many years later, Washington, about 15 years later, was out in this same area looking over some land that he had purchased. And when an Indian chief who had taken part in this battle heard that Washington was there, he went to seek him out. He said, I remember you. You were back in this battle. And George Washington Parke Custis, who was George Washington's adopted son, he was his grandson through marrying Martha. He married Martha Washington, who was a widow and had some children, and two of her grandchildren grew up in the home of George and Martha Washington. And the grandson, George Washington Parke Custis, compiled some memoirs, a book about his famous grandfather, and records many stories. And here he talks about this Indian chief said, our rifles were leveled, rifles which, but for him, knew not how to miss. 'Twas all in vain. A power mightier far than we shielded him from harm. He cannot die in battle. I am old, and soon shall be gathered to the great council fire of my fathers in the land of shades. But ere before I go, there is something bids me speak in the voice of prophecy. Listen, the Great Spirit protects that man and guides his destinies. He will become the chief of nations, and a people yet unborn will hail him as the founder of a mighty empire. So here it was, during this battle of the Monongahela, when Washington was fired upon many, many times, he couldn't be, wasn't hurt and harmed. And even the Indians recognized that God, the Great Spirit, had something that he wanted him to do, and it wasn't to be slain in battle. Washington recognized the hand of providence as well, because not long after this incident, he wrote a letter on July 18, 1755, saying, "As I have heard since my arrival at this place, a circumstantial account of my death and dying speech, I take this early opportunity of contradicting both, and of assuring you that I now exist and appear in the land of the living by the miraculous care of Providence that protected me beyond all human expectation. I had 4 bullets through my coat and 2 horses shot under me, and yet escaped unhurt." Because rumors had gone forth that Washington was killed along with so many of the other officers. He was writing a letter to his brother to correct false news. And he said, "Look, but by the miraculous care of Providence, I've been protected beyond all human probability or expectation. He had 4 bullets through his coat, 2 horses shot up from under me." His grandson, George Washington Parke Custis, used to have a hat on display at his home, the Arlington House, which is still there today, across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. And he used to display a hat that he said it had a bullet hole through it that was the hat that his grandfather, George Washington, had worn at the Battle of the Monongahela. And it was another bullet that passed through, and he remained unharmed. It was then a month after this letter he wrote on August 17, 1755, that Samuel Davies, who was a minister during the First Great Awakening, he preached a sermon, an artillery sermon, as troops, some militia was preparing to gather together, that he, in his sermon, he spoke of, quote, "that heroic youth, Colonel Washington, whom I cannot but hope Providence has hitherto preserved in so signal a manner for some important service to his country." So you see here, early on, 23 years old, Washington witnessed and acknowledged the hand of God. The providence of God was watching over his life. The Indians recognized the providence of God. This minister, Samuel Davies, recognized the providence of God, that God in his providence watches over his people. And he was watching over George Washington in order to accomplish his purpose in his life, but also in the history of the nation, which affected the history of the world. This is the same God that watches over us. What a great encouragement that providential history gives to each one of us. We recognize that God in his sovereignty is accomplishing his purposes, and he uses men like George Washington and like you and like me to accomplish the purpose, and he'll give us everything we need. He'll watch over us and keep and protect us. And for George Washington, as Samuel Davies said, as the Indian chief said, they couldn't help but think that God had something very important that he wanted to do in service to his country. And it certainly was true of George Washington, because he was an indispensable man. Without Washington, we likely never would have won the American Revolution, and never would have had a constitutional convention, not had an example of a president who exercised limited power under our new republic, and never been birthed as the free nation that is we have today. So Washington early on was a man of providence. And later on during the American Revolution, all of his troops knew that of these incidents is because Washington, after this Battle of the Monongahela, wrote up a report. This report was published. People began to read it and began to recognize this man, George Washington, and in particular, how he was preserved in battle. Now, Washington was also a man of Christian character, a man of providence. He is a man who feared God, as we will look at later on. And he was a man who displayed Christian character. Tobias Lear was George Washington's personal secretary in the last few years of his life. After he finished his second term as president of the United States in the 1790s, he retired to Mount Vernon. And he, for a few years, had a Tobias Lear live in his home to help him compile his records and other things. And Tobias Lear, after living and observing Washington, made this statement. He said, "I have never found a single thing that should lessen my respect for him. A complete knowledge of his honesty, uprightness, and candor in all his private transactions has sometimes led me to think him more than a man." What a testimony or statement from someone who knew him personally, saw his daily workings and his personal private life, to make such a statement. "I've never found a single thing that could lessen my respect for him. A complete knowledge of his honesty, uprightness, and candor in all his private transactions has sometimes led me to think him more than a man." Now, of course, he was just a man, but after gaining victory in the American Revolution, he became probably the most famous man in the world, and people adored him so much that John Adams said he was fearful that the people were making a god out of him. I like the anecdotal story that was told of Washington that, now, while he was president, his first year as president, the national government was kept at New York City. Then it moved to Philadelphia. So for most of the years of his presidency, he lived in Philadelphia. And one day he was walking down the street, and right just across the street, there is a man with his young son walking along. Now, everybody knew George Washington. They knew who he was, knew what he did. They adored him. Some, as Adam said, almost were making a god out of him. But most people didn't know what Washington looked like, because most people did not have paintings. Few people did. They were expensive. You, of course, didn't have pictures and cameras or anything like this. So they're walking down the street, and as they walked past Washington, the father remarked to his young son, he said, "Look, there goes General Washington." And the little boy looked over, and he looked up with very big eyes, and he said, "Why, he's a man after all." Of course, he was just a man, but the young boy had heard so much about this famous individual that he thought he must have been more than a man. But as Tobias Lear said, he said sometimes his character and actions and uprightness led him to think him more than a man. But he was a man of Christian character, and it was this Christian character that gave him power. Now, see, Washington was not a very talkative man. He's not known for his great oratorical skills or ability to use words. But when he spoke, people listened. And it was the character behind his words that gave force to his words. The power of his words, the impact that they would have upon individuals was based upon the character behind them. That was true for him. It's true for us today. One example of the power of his words can be seen in an incident that occurred during the American Revolution. Now, after Washington was chosen commanding general of the army, his first orders issued on July 4, 1775, among his first orders, he forbade profane cursing, swearing, and drunkenness. Now, we might think, wow, if we could just get our officers, just keep them from cursing and swearing, you know, if they cursed and swore and kept them from all the other bad activity, you know, we'd be okay. But no, Washington, as did the generation at that time, recognized the nature of cursing and swearing, using profanity. See, they believe that in a society where profanity flourished, it was an indication of decline of character in the heart of the people, because what one invokes in word is a indication of the heart of the man, who men appeal to as the source of what they think is right and true or good comes out. And so when you're cursing, you're not appealing to the high things of God. You're appealing to low and debased things. See, they considered it one of the lowest sins that you could commit, cursing, because it revealed you had no self-government, had no ability to control your words, and it reflected what was in your heart. So they said, well, we're not going to have that. Well, he forbade profane cursing, swearing, and drunkenness. Well, during the war, one afternoon, Washington was entertaining some of his officers at dinner in his tent. And during this meal, one of the officers uttered an oath. Well, Washington dropped his knife and fork and said in his characteristic dignity, "I thought that we all supposed ourselves gentlemen." Well, the remark struck like an electric shock, and, as was intended, did execution. No person swore at the table after that. When dinner was over, the officer referred to said to a companion that if the general had given him a blow over the head with his sword, he could have borne it, but that the home thrust which he received was too much. It was too much for a gentleman. See, there was power in Washington's words because of the character behind the man who was speaking. Now, Washington's Christian character was displayed, especially during the American Revolution, and especially at one of the very important turning points or events that occurred during the war. And it was an event, not a battle, where the men were fighting and gaining a victory, but it was during that very difficult winter at Valley Forge, during the winter of 1777 and 1778. Now, during winter at this time, generally armies would not fight because the weather was so bad. They would take winter quarters, hold out to the spring, then come back out in the field and resume their conflicts. And so during the winter of 1777, Washington, wanting to be close to the British who had taken up residency in houses of the colonists in Philadelphia, Washington wanted to be near him to keep an eye on the enemy. And so he moved into winter quarters at Valley Forge, which is just outside of Philadelphia. Now, when the troops marched into Valley Forge, of course, Valley Forge, it was just out in the middle of the woods at the time, where they had to construct little huts to live in during that winter. But the army was in very difficult shape as they marched into Valley Forge because they had not had enough food to eat. They didn't have enough clothing. This was one of the difficulties of the Continental Congress. They had no power to raise money to help support the troops in the field. Washington, a lot of his work and effort was trying to get aid and support and supplies for his troops, and would appeal to governors and people living in the local community and to the Congress, everybody he could. As one observer said, speaking about the condition as they marched into Valley Forge, said, for the want of shoes, their marches through frost and snow might be traced by the blood from their feet. And they were almost as often without provisions as with them. So here's the situation, the condition as they marched into Valley Forge, that they Their shoes had worn through. They had to wrap their feet with cloths, and the frozen ice would cut through these wrappings, and their feet would begin to bleed. He said you could trace their marches from the blood from their feet. And Washington actually wrote to the Continental Congress saying the very same thing of how you could see the blood from their feet, and was appealing for supplies. So this was it, marching in to begin this difficult winter. They didn't have enough provisions. They didn't have enough clothes. That Baron von Steuben, who is a Prussian soldier who came during the winter of Valley Forge to offer his services, said the men were literally naked, some of them in the fullest extent of the word. Lafayette, who was a Frenchman who had offered his services in the cause of liberty to the American army, came almost like a son to George Washington, said the army frequently remained whole days without provisions. In fact, many men's feet and legs froze till they became black, and it was often necessary to amputate them. Washington would write to the Congress, "I feel superabundantly for them, and from my soul I pity those miseries which it is neither in my power to relieve or prevent." And so the situation at Valley Forge was bleak. A third of the soldiers became incapacitated, not fit for battle, because they were sick and laid up in their very crude huts that they had built to live during the winter. So they were exposed to cold. Their legs became black and had to amputate them. They didn't have enough food. They became sick. It was just extremely difficult time. One historian, Henry Brown, describes the condition and the situation this way. He said, "The blood that stained this ground did not rush forth in the joyous frenzy of the fight. It fell drop by drop from the heart of a suffering people. They who once encamped here in the snow fought not for conquest, not for power, not for glory, not for their country only, not for themselves alone. They served here for posterity. They suffered here for the human race. They bore here the cross of all the peoples. They died here that freedom might be the heritage of all." Here's one of many examples in the history of our nation where people who've gone before us laid down their lives, gave and suffered, not so much for them, but for us. Here's an example of men who suffered and died to fight against those who would take away our life, liberty, and property, and assured that we became a free nation, a nation birthed in liberty, that we've been had that freedom bought for us by these men, like these men who suffered at Valley Forge. And so here is the difficult situation during the winter of 1777 and 1778. And Washington, you know, felt helpless in many ways. Now, he, of course, was doing all he could to get supplies for his troops and other things, and he worked effortlessly day and night. But it's also here that his faith was on display, that morning and evening his tent was a place of prayer, one observer says. Henry Muhlenberg, the father of introducing Lutheranism into America, visited Washington and spoke of his faith and how that sustained him, and spoke of his praying and crying out to God. Now, the story goes that some don't think this ever happened in this specific way. Some historians, some say that it would, but it certainly reflects the character and sentiment of George Washington, of how he responded during this difficult winter. Because Isaac Potts relates how one day he was going through the woods to his home. He had a house that was near Valley Forge, and he heard some noise over into the woods, and he quietly crept up in the woods, looking and seeing what the noise was, and there he saw George Washington on his knees in prayer. Now, there have been many paintings that have been made depicting this particular incident. On our book, America's Providential History, we use one of those paintings that an immigrant from Scandinavia painted, so 50 or so years ago, as a gift to the country that meant so much to him, that depicts the history, the foundation of a nation, Washington, in prayer at Valley Forge. But there's been many others that depict this incident as well. And so Isaac Potts came up, listened to him praying very quietly, didn't move until Washington finished, got up and left. Well, Isaac Potts then went to his house, and he remarked to his wife, "If there is anyone on this earth whom the Lord will listen to, it is George Washington. And I feel a presentiment that under such a commander there can be no doubt of our eventually establishing our independence, and that God in his providence has willed it so." Now, we know Washington prayed, whether this story of Potts is true or not, because many others observed him in prayer at Valley Forge, officers, troops, outside observers like Henry Muhlenberg and others. And not only was he praying, but of course many other troops were praying, many families at home were praying, states were praying as well. In fact, during the American Revolution, there was at least 15 times when state governments proclaimed official days of prayer and fasting, or prayer and thanksgiving, throughout this struggle, because they recognized we need the aid and assistance of God if we're going to succeed in this great conflict. And so prayer was going on throughout the American Revolution, and families and churches and states, and Washington was just doing what everyone else was doing as well. And the good thing is, God answered the prayer of Washington, the prayer of so many others, in miraculous ways. Now, one thing that the Americans needed was food. They were starving to death and didn't have enough food. And so God began to answer that supply. Here it was in the winter, still wintertime, when one day they saw a great disturbance in the Schuylkill River, because they were camped right near next to that river, and they saw it kind of look like it was boiling up. And when they looked closer, they saw that there were thousands and thousands of shad migrating up the river unusually early. That usually didn't take place till springtime. So here it was, they went out and began to take pitchforks and shovels and catch these fish, throw them up on shore where thousands of fish were caught. So God miraculously supplied food that the army desperately needed through this migration of the fish. And interestingly, just a couple of weeks before this, someone sent a wagon load of salt to the troops, you know, to the army that was at Valley Forge, and they wondered, what are we going to do with this salt? We don't have any meat to preserve the salt, but now God sent in the fish, and they could use the salt to preserve the fish, which they would eat for quite some time after this. So that was one example of answered prayer. Now, another is when Baron von Steuben marched into the camp during the time of Valley Forge and offered his services. He was a professional army, as I said, from Prussia, and wanted to support the cause of liberty. And he said, "Here I am to assist in any way I can." And so he, during that winter, began to train the officers, run them through drills, and get them in order, who in turn would train the troops. Because when the Continental Army marched in the Valley Forge, they were not a professional army. They were mostly a bunch of farmers and laborers who turned out and said, you know, we want to fight for the cause of liberty. But they had never undergone military training of any depth. So here, Baron von Steuben's training helped to make them a disciplined army. So when they marched out of Valley Forge in the spring of 1778, they marched out a well-disciplined army. And then another way that God answered prayer was that France became an ally of the United States. The fall before, at the Battle of Saratoga, God miraculously gave American forces a victory over the British. And after that occurred, the French, who were enemies of the English, decided, well, these colonies, they have a chance to win this thing. And so they decided that we're going to become an ally. And so much needed resources began to flow to the Americans, and most especially a navy. The French Navy, because Americans really didn't have a navy, came with them. Now, after getting word of this signing of this alliance treaty, George Washington issued order to his troops in which he said, "It having pleased the Almighty Ruler of the Universe propitiously to defend the cause of the United American States, and finally, by raising up a powerful friend among the princes of the earth, to establish our liberty and independence upon a lasting foundation, it becomes us to set apart a day for gratefully acknowledging the divine goodness and celebrating the event which we owe to his benign interposition." So here it is. Washington said, okay, we're going to set aside a day of thanksgiving unto God. Troops, everyone's going to go, going to go to divine service, hear God, and give thanks to him. Now, Washington not only did that in the field with his troops, but the Continental Congress, when they got word of France becoming an ally, they proclaimed a day of prayer and thanksgiving and gave thanks to Almighty God for raising up this powerful ally to assist them in their struggle for independence. So here we see George Washington acknowledging the providence of God officially and in his personal life, the Continental Congress acknowledging the providence of God. We see God miraculously preserving Washington, defending the cause of American liberty, answering prayer in miraculous ways. And this would continue during the war, after the war, and the events that follow. And so in our next America's Providential History podcast, we're going to pick up the story of George Washington, man of providence, and we're going to look at other examples of how God providentially watched over his life, how he used him, how the words of Washington reflect his faith in God as well. So I will hope you will join us on our next podcast to continue this story of George Washington, man of providence. And if you want to learn more, you can pick up some of our books, my biography, Apostle of Liberty, The World-Changing Leadership of George Washington, to read all these stories. You can pick up our book, America's Providential History, that talks about events during the American Revolution and how God moved on our behalf. You can find these at providencefoundation.com. Well, I hope God bless you. Look forward to having you with us next week.